Get two or more people gathered at a campfire, and they'll start doing what? Telling stories. We seem to have a compulsion to tell stories, whether it's the joke about three Irishmen in a bar or War and Peace. We'll find out about that compulsion in the hour to come. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. We'll catch up on some of the findings about storytelling and our need for it from Indre Viscontis, neuroscientist, opera singer, and professor of sciences and humanities at San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Welcome to University of the Air.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're an opera singer, so of course right away that plays to two of our basic needs. One is music, and the other is storytelling. But what got you interested in the neurological aspects of storytelling?
Well, to be completely honest, it's now kind of a cliched answer. It was the writing of Oliver Sacks.
Oh, really?
Famous neurologist.
Musicophilia.
Yeah,
and
well,
other books.
It was before Musicophilia. I actually had the pleasure of working with him on Musicophilia.
Great.
But yeah, when I was in high school, I discovered some of his writings, Island of the Colorblind and An Anthropologist on Mars. And the way that he told the stories of his patients were so compelling to me and just fundamentally shifted how I approached my own mind. That I decided, wow, I really need to delve into this more deeply.
As a neurologist.
As a neuroscientist. Yeah, I actually wrote to him and asked him, I don't know what to do. Should I go and be, you know, a psychology student or should I try to get into medical school and become a neurologist? And he wrote back and he said, I think you should become a neurologist because that will give you access to patients. But I didn't take his advice. Instead, I went into psychology.
Well, how do you begin? How do you proceed?
From, you know, in terms of the education or?
Well, finding out, finding out what is this physiological component?
Yeah, so I take the approach that, you know, we are products of evolution and natural selection selected certain behaviors in us. And that to me is a really interesting way of framing the question of why our brains are the way they are today. Because, you know, there are a lot of different paths that evolution could have taken, and yet here we are. And so that's where I begin. And so I actually look to one part of our evolutionary history when all of a sudden in the fossil record, our skull size grew exponentially.
Right.
So we don't have, you know, brains, they disintegrate, right? but we have skull sizes. And so we can make the inference that because we have bigger skulls, we had bigger brains. And this happened at a time when we started living in social groups, bigger groups. And so Robin Dunbar has proposed the social brain hypothesis, which is this idea that, in fact, one of the selection pressures that really shaped our brain is the fact that we need to navigate social relationships and understand each other and predict what each of us is going to do. And to me, that's fundamentally where stories come in. How do we understand each other? We put ourselves into each other's shoes. How do we train our children to behave, you know, in moral ways? We tell them stories of good behavior. And that's where I think this kind of the beginning of this idea that stories are fundamental, in my opinion, comes from the fact that we need to live together in communities.
Of course, language is fundamental to that. You can have a big brain, wouldn't necessarily be that dense, you know. Neanderthals, didn't they have a larger brain cavity than Homo sapiens?
Yeah, they did. And it's unclear whether their brains were more folded or not than ours. So the question is, you know, it's not just about size. It's also about connections. So, for example, Einstein didn't have a particularly big brain. In fact, every time we've sort of looked to see what we can find in Einstein's brain that is different from the average brain, you know, it's all a little bit murky. So it's really unclear. But, you know, I think that what we do know is that certainly language is a fundamental component, but you can tell stories without using language. And that's what music does, right? Especially music that doesn't have a vocal line.
Yes, although it may be a different story for me than it is for you if I'm listening to, say, the classical symphony of Prokofiev.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, I think that the melodic nature of speech is an important component of storytelling. The great storytellers have a certain prosody. You know, that's if you're just monotone, that's a very bad way of telling a story.
That's true, unless you know, it's, yeah.
So pitch matters, modulation matters, and, yes. and that emotional component of language that we hear in speech through pitch modulation, I think, is fundamental, again, to storytelling.
Sure, and cadence and rhythm and the variation of both.
Exactly, exactly. So I think that you can have the sort of, you know, core of storytelling even necessarily without language, although of course language enriches it much, much more deeply. But I don't know that we needed to speak to each other in order to sort of get at this understanding of human behavior. So there's another idea about what it is that allows us to understand each other's behaviors and develop what we call theory of mind, which is this idea that you have intentions and beliefs that may be the same or different from mine, but you have them and they drive your behavior. Right. So how does this is a actually pretty complex thing when you think about it. Does your cat have theory of mind or does it just respond?
Yeah, sure.
You know, to how you do. Is it really thinking, you know, how to deceive you and you know, how to get you to open that can of tuna? I don't know. Or is it just, you know, responding? I think that's still debatable. But we certainly know because we can talk about it that human beings have this ability. And
yes.
And there's a time in childhood when it develops.
That's where it gets very interesting, isn't it?
Very interesting.
There's a time in childhood where it develops and the manipulation of the parent by the child, which can happen as early as just a couple of months.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. And when the child, you know, I have a 2-year-old and he's you know, going through this in different phases, but I can, and maybe I'm just projecting, but I feel like I can see in his eyes when he's trying to figure out what is mama thinking.
Mm-hmm.
How did we develop this ability? One idea is that by essentially imagining what it would be like to be in your shoes, what my brain does is it kind of, you know, activates some of the same brain regions that are active in your brain when you're doing a particular action. Let's say I watch you grasp a cup, for example, to get a glass of water. If I'm focusing in on that, there's potentially a part of my brain that's actually mimicking what it's like, what it would be like if I was grasping that cup.
Right.
We call this the mirror neuron system. And there's certainly some controversy about the extent to which mirror neurons in humans are the same as they were first discovered in primates. And certainly there's been a lot of hyperbole in terms of how the mirror neuron system has been interpreted in terms of individuals on the autism spectrum and so forth. So I'm not going to necessarily go into that. But there is a fundamental truth there that we do understand, which is that when we are trying to empathize with another human being, we do actually see some similar brain activity in the brain of the listener, say, as we do in the brain of a performer when we're talking about music.
So if you're telling me I picked up a mug and it was cold and I tipped it and it had a certain kind of weight to it and I could feel the water sloshing in it, those receptors are firing in my head when you're telling me about that sensation.
Yeah. So how are you actually able to imagine what that would be like? You're actually activating the brain regions that would be activated were you actually experiencing those sensations. So that's we know that for sure. In fact, when we see people remember vivid experiences from their past, let's say I ask you about your wedding. Can you, I don't know if you're married, but if you are, can you go back to your wedding day and what can you re-experience from that day? Do you remember what the weather was like, what the sights and sounds were, what the smells were, etc.? So every time you remember a different component, the part of your brain that initially was activated in the moment gets reactivated. And that's how your memory works for these kinds of events. And in fact, that is also where I see one of the fundamental aspects of storytelling, which is in our memories for events. How do we remember events? We retell the story. So a lot of people think about memory as being just a record of the past. But in fact, we neuroscientists know that that's not true. It's not like you have a record of the past, say, and you write it in your diary, and then you put your diary away, and then when you want it again, you just take out your diary and you read what you wrote. That's actually not how it works. How it works is that you take out that diary and you rewrite that experience. So how you are feeling in the moment, etc., is going to affect how you remember.
Well, that raises a couple of questions. One is, I've seen this many years ago, actually, a patient undergoing brain surgery, and they're conscious. They, I guess, have to be for brain surgery. And when certain parts of the brain are touched, the patient starts saying, oh, it's my wedding day, and I can, you know, smell the punch, and I can see, you know, the bride and the rustling of her wedding gown and all that. Question number one is the complete memory, so far as we know, stored? Or, as you say, if it's rewritten, is it potentially and almost inevitably distorted over the course of time?
Yeah. So the answer to that question is it's almost inevitably distorted over time. There's still some debate as to how the storage works. There are sort of two main parts of the brain that are involved in storing these long-term memories of events. The hippocampus, which is involved in creating new long-term memories. So, for example, if you don't have a hippocampus, it's very hard for you to lay down new long-term memories. You sort of live in this perpetual present. And then other parts of the cortex where older memories may have been what we call consolidated or stored. And all new long-term memories require the hippocampus in order to be retrieved. And the hippocampus acts as a kind of pointer. So there's a whole bunch of parts of your brain that are active when you're having an experience, and the hippocampus makes a note of what's active in that moment. And then when you're remembering, it essentially reactivates all those parts to give you that experience again. Now, the older the memory, it is possible that in some cases, some of those parts of the brain that were active now become independent of the hippocampus. And this is still an area of some debate. So I'm being a bit careful about it. Because in my reading of the data, actually, the hippocampus is always necessary for this re-experiencing component of it. But in any case, what is happening when you have that kind of what we call intracranial stimulation in the neurosurgery, as you described? Well, first of all, the reason that the patients have to stay awake is that the surgeon wants to avoid parts of the brain that are really important, like language areas, right? Because if you become mute after surgery, that's a bad thing.
Yes.
Not to say that there's any part of the brain that is, you know, that we can just not use. We do use all of our brain all the time. But some parts are more important for daily living. But usually when those areas are stimulated, a person kind of has this experience, but, you know, it's not necessarily that it's the entire memory and its entire, you know, beautiful narrative structure that comes back. But we absolutely do know that when you retrieve a memory, you fundamentally change how that memory is then restored, because we can see in lots of different experiments how this works. And in fact, that's one of the ideas behind the treatment of individuals who have post-traumatic stress disorder, where essentially you have a problem of episodic memories gone awry, you know, taking over, becoming intrusive into a person's mind. And in some treatments of those patients, sometimes what you want to do is you want to have them remember what happened, but separate the emotional experience from the sort of memory to neutralize it.
That sounds like a tall order. How do you do
it
that?
Is.
How do you ever disassociate emotion from memory?
So very, very carefully in the, you know, psychologist's office through what's called exposure therapy. And there's some controversy because it can have in a maybe 20 to 30% of PTSD patients a negative side effect where actually it doesn't work and now they are worse off because they've had more of these experiences. But in a relatively large proportion of patients, it can be very effective. So it's done a little bit like the analogy is sort of like, how do you get over someone's phobia of spiders, for example,
right?
Which is an irrational fear of you know, something. And so you have to condition it out of them. You have to allow them to experience the thing that they fear and not have anything bad happen to them. So that's this exposure therapy.
That worked, I guess, for J.R.R. Tolkien, as he was afraid of spiders, but he wrote about them periodically in his writings.
Yeah. So it can be very effective, but it's not something that you can do in your backyard. So you have to do it in very carefully controlled settings. But yeah, so we know that we can rewrite these memories. And we also know that we can induce false memories.
Yes.
Right? So it's the same kind of idea, is that, you know, so Elizabeth Loftus has done some really wonderful work in inducing these false memories in people by doing things like, you know, showing them a picture of themselves at a, you know, amusement park where she's photoshopped in a character that is impossible, right? So Bugs Bunny at Disneyland, right? And people will report, you know, a vivid memory of meeting Bugs Bunny at Disneyland, when obviously that, you know, can't be right.
And how do you implant that memory?
So you do it through subtle kind of suggestible exposures. So, you know, you have people remember aspects of their childhood, and then you show them this photograph and ask them to elaborate on it. And so essentially you have them, you know, going through the process of recreating that memory, essentially retelling the story of what happened.
Or creating a story around that image.
Well, the question is, do we always just create a story around some cue or some image? Are we really actually remembering the way we think we are, or are we just telling ourselves a good story?
But you always have to, like, connect the dots. I mean, you never have 100% data, or at least you can't be aware of it, I would think. And so if I tell somebody about this conversation with you, I might not remember, you know, what you're wearing, or I might think I remember what you're wearing and put that into the story, and maybe even be sure that I'm right about that, and then come back and look and no, that's a false memory.
Yeah. So, you know, Dan Schachter has a great way of categorizing memory problems into sins of commission and sins of omission, right? So there are things that we will omit. We forgot. There are certain details. There are sins of commission, too, where we'll have, you know, maybe you'll confuse me with someone else who looks very similar and was wearing something, you know, similar or so forth. So we can have different memory failures. But what we're learning from these failures is that maybe the whole point of memory is not just to have this accurate record of the past. Maybe it has some other purpose. And the purpose that I think really memory has is to allow us to imagine, to give us the tools from which we can build an imaginatory, essentially our imagination. So,
well, again, we have to imagine some things, don't we? We have, in other words, it's a surmise, which in effect is imagining. Well, she said A and she said C, and so I think maybe she must have said B also.
That's right. There's a lot of inference that happens, and that's the storytelling aspect of remembering. And, you know, we know from patients who are unable to lay down new long-term memories because, you know, they have hippocampal damage, they can't remember the recent past. They also can't imagine the future.
Really?
Yeah. So they stay very much in the present. If you ask them, what are you going to do a week from now? It's baffling to them. They can't imagine. They can't put that together. And we see, you know, your ability to recollect details from a past event is tied to your ability to imagine a future event. So,
really?
You know, there is this strong connection between, you know, imagining and predicting future outcomes and the ability to, you know, create a vivid re-experience of something in your past.
Yes, I suppose on the most basic level. If I remember seeing the sunrise this morning, I can surmise in the future, tomorrow, the sun will rise. But for a more complicated pattern to perceive that and project it into the future would require analysis and a degree of imagination.
Yeah, and this same ability to activate multiple brain regions at the same time. So, you know, some of the music students that I work with at the Conservatory of Music, you know, they use imagery as a way of getting over stage fright, for example, or even, you know, memorizing certain pieces of music. And sometimes they come to my classroom and they say, well, I'm just not very good at this kind of imagination. And it turns out it's something that you can practice.
What kind of imagination to get over stage fright?
So you literally go through a process of imagining what it's going to be like from every little detail when you walk onto that stage.
And oh, what I've heard of that in sports too.
Sports use it all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And so, and in fact, it's effective. You can watch what's happening in the brains of athletes as they are imagining, you know, a particular, you know, great success in their athletic feat. And they can improve in their skills just by imagining it. I mean, obviously not entirely. You can't just do that. You can't be an armchair athlete. But there are measurable gains that we can see when people go through this, you know, vivid, explicit imagination. So you can actually, and, you know, look, your brain is rewiring itself all the time. I mean, that's actually how the brain works, right? Through its connections. I think what's something that's really poetic is that there's not a single neuron in your brain that doesn't make a meaningful connection, because if that was the case, it dies. Literally, they die.
Use so, it or lose it.
Use it or lose it. So you know, that's the, so you can rewire, essentially, some of these parts of the brain through vivid imagination. Of course, it's not as easy as, you know, doing things, and there are much more, and there are certainly parts of the brain that are more malleable than others, but we can see these wiring changes with something as seemingly innocuous as imagination.
We get into a big realm here of sleep and dreams, and I was talking to somebody about this just a day or so ago, about rats who are trained to run mazes, and the scientists can, of course, trace the firings in the rat's brain as it learns the maze. And then when the rat goes to sleep, the same patterns are firing as the rat is learning the maze in his sleep.
And we see it in humans. So some of my work for my PhD was actually looking at recordings from individual neurons deep within the brain of patients with epilepsy. So they're on the board because they're candidates for surgery. We need to figure out where the seizures are starting. So we record from deep within their brain. And in one of the studies that my colleagues did is they had these patients watch a movie, the Good, Bad, and the Ugly was one that I remember.
Clint Eastwood.
And they would track the patterns of neural activation while the person was watching the movie. And then while they were sleeping, they saw replaying of those same patterns.
Wow.
So we know that, like, sleep is a time in which the brain really is very active and is doing some fundamental things, particularly when it comes to learning. And when if we get back to this idea of separating the emotion from the memory, as we talked about earlier in patients with PTSD, my friend at Berkeley, Matt Walker, who's a wonderful sleep researcher, has this theory that, and it's backed up by some pretty solid evidence, that what is happening in the healthy brain during REM sleep or rapid eye movement sleep, which is when, you know, about 80% of our dreaming happens, is that you are, you know, re-experiencing essentially some of these emotional things that happened to you during the day, and you're essentially stripping away the emotional experience from the content of the memory. You really want to remember the content. That's what's important, right? Was this something that I need to avoid in the future or approach? You don't want to keep re-experiencing the emotion, because that's just, you know,
because it's hard to analyze it through emotion.
Well, and also emotions are you know, it's hard to be emotional, right? It takes a physical toll.
That's true.
Right?
It does burn you out.
that's why PTSD is so hard to handle, essentially, because you're going through the emotion every time. You're going through this fight or flight reaction. And what he suggests is that what's gone awry in patients with PTSD is this ability during REM sleep to remove the emotion, because their adrenaline levels are higher than they are in healthy individuals who go through REM sleep. So he was telling me that apparently during REM sleep, that's a time in the 24-hour cycle where these levels of, you know, the hormones involved in fight or flight are at their lowest. So if you have, you know, this memory, you're not going to necessarily go into this emotional reaction because the hormones just aren't there to support it. But in patients with PTSD, it's possible that, in fact, they have higher levels of this hormone during this one stage of sleep that is restorative for most of us, so they don't get the benefit of removing that emotion.
And, of course, that cycle would feed on itself. I mean, if you don't get the REM sleep that you know, refreshes you and enables you to analyze the thing tonight, you'll be that much more vulnerable tomorrow night.
And not only that, but you won't even want to go to sleep,
right?
Because you might wake up with this panicked feeling. So yeah, it's a really vicious cycle. And, you know, I really commend Matt for his work, because I think that this has a potential cure, essentially, for this devastating condition. Because if you can somehow reinduce this therapeutic aspect of REM sleep, potentially you can really help these patients.
We're going to look further and more deeply into this phenomenon of the need, the physiological need for stories, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Indre Vasconthis, who is a neuroscientist at the University of San Francisco and also an opera singer affiliated with the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. And how do those two tie together? Well, through storytelling, and that's the subject of this conversation, the need for stories in the human condition. We talked a lot about memory and experiencing things and then re-experiencing them without the emotion in order to learn from them and to project, say, a future from them. But what about things that you experience without knowing it? There's this, I guess, fairly well-known exercise online where you watch some people playing basketball, and then you're asked later about the gorilla.
Yeah.
And you go back and the gorilla was there, but you didn't see it. How does that play into memory and the story, the narrative of your experience?
So that's it's a great experiment designed by Dan Simons and Christopher Chabris. And essentially what they do is they have, you know, if you've never seen this before, I actually encourage you to go online and watch the video. But they give you a task, you know, count the number of passes by the team wearing white T-shirts or something like that. And the better you are at doing that counting, the more likely you are to miss the gorilla, which is literally a person in a gorilla suit that walks into the middle of the screen, shakes his hands, and then walks off. And this phenomenon is called inattentional blindness. Essentially, it gets at the fact that, you know, we think that we are generally good at paying attention to things that are around us. But in fact, the more focused we are on a particular task, the more we disregard all the other things that might be available to us through our senses. And it's amazing, because if you look at people's eye movements while they're watching this video, individuals who miss the gorilla are just as likely to have fixated on the part of the screen that the gorilla was in. So it's not like you're actually not looking, you're just not seeing. And that's because, of course, you're engaging your brain in a way, in a task that is, you know, you're focusing on something else. So what that tells us is that as we're going around in the world, you know, we are only actually encoding or essentially, you know, seeing a very small portion of it. And the rest of the time, our brain kind of fills in all the details. And that's because most of the time, we want to look for things in the environment that are changing, that are giving us meaningful information, right? We want to see the tiger in the trees, not the trees
right.
in the forest, right? So our brain kind of ignores things that don't change, especially in the visual world. And that also actually explains why movies and TV series work, right? Because there are always problems of continuity
right? The glass is fuller,
later. The person's hair is, you know, in a different, you know, and some people notice these, but for the most part, we don't notice them. And this is called change blindness, is that we are actually blind to change when it doesn't seem to be, you know, particularly meaningful or important, when it's not the focus. So that allows for that component of storytelling that you know, Hollywood thrives on. So it just kind of underscores this, you know, this way that we interact with the world, which is relatively small and focused. But that's good, because we're bombarded with a ton of information, and most of it is irrelevant. And in order for us to, you know, figure out what's really important, we have to be able to focus our attention. This is where it comes in. But the change blindness examples also allow for magicians to do their work, right? What do magicians do?
Sure.
They essentially capture your attention and distract you from, you know, seeing the trick.
What about, as opposed to things that you just don't notice, things that you actually deliberately deceive yourself about?
Yeah. So we do know that we have what's called a confirmation bias, which is this idea that if we have a particular belief, whether it's, you know, about the world being round, the sun, you know, setting at a certain time or what have you, instead of actually finding information that disconfirms the belief, which is actually more useful information because you only need one instance, we look for information that confirms the beliefs. So we actually are biased towards seeing information that goes into in line with our beliefs and ideas rather than that disconfirms them. So this is how you can have very different political views in a country, people who are getting essentially the same information, but
right.
you know, come away with a very different story from the information that they were presented. Because people remember and pick up things that are in line with their own beliefs. And so, you know, this confirmation bias must somehow be helpful to us in a certain way. And there's some debate as to, you know, how that's helpful to the human being.
Well, it strengthens your position, or at least you think it does, if it verifies what you think you know.
Yeah, it maybe gives you a sense of confidence about that. Maybe
right.
it helps with the existential crisis of, you know, living in a chaotic world. Maybe it helps bind people together into social groups if they can then, you know, have similar beliefs, and that helps with social cohesion and things like that. But it also means that when we experience the environment, we tend to notice things that are in line with what we expect, or that, you know, are in line with our beliefs. And of course, we can be surprised often. And so the brain kind of has these two forces that kind of act in concert. And one is this, you know, it's this idea of habituation, which is that when you experience something over and over and over again, and it's not really damaging you, or and it's not really providing you with anything good, you kind of habituate to it, you ignore it. So a great example is when you move into a new house and you go to sleep at night, every single noise wakes you up, right? But eventually, you know, even after just a course of a couple of nights, you can sleep through the sound of the heater turning on. So it's called habituation. And so, you know, we do habituate to the environment of things that aren't that important to us. But, you know, when there are surprising things, you know, that we, you know, we they can draw our attention and pull us away from this habituated state.
In the course of telling a story, and let's say, for starters, that it's a novel, I can be faulted by one group of readers or another if I tell a story that's too idealistic. You know, A meets B, they hit it off, they live happily ever after. But somebody in this camp will say, that's not real life. And I said, well, if I told you about real life, it would be far too chaotic and confusing to keep track of. If I told you every little detail of everything they did, every little moment of doubt and unhappiness getting to that. And so there's this whole spectrum between oversimplified storytelling and storytelling with so many details that you lose the story.
Yeah. And, you know, in theater, we also talk about stakes, right? How high are the stakes? You know, so if I just told you about my daily life, that's really not that interesting, although there are some novels that now are written.
Well, right. That's
you know,
right.
Yeah. As in a reaction to these other, you know, high stakes, high drama. So, yeah, there's people have different tastes in terms of what they want out of their drama, whether it's or their story, whether it's a novel or an opera or, you know, a play. And I think that there's a lot of room for all kinds of different, you know, levels of engagement in terms of the stakes. But I still think that there is a real artistry towards telling that good story and being true to whatever it is, the genre that you're presenting. You know, we have a part of the brain called the caudate, which is involved in the reward system. So, you know, it's essentially is involved in what I like to think, not just reward, but salience, the meaningful things in the world. So they could be good or bad. You still want to pay attention to the things in the world that, you know, predict a certain outcome. And the caudate is one of these parts of the brain that is involved in learning, you know, how to predict these outcomes and how to make these associations. And the reason I'm mentioning the caudate is because when we look at the brains of people who are enjoying music, say, for example, mm-hmm. who are getting that sublime experience of the chills, you know, when you get the goosebumps, mm-hmm. it's wonderful. We find that when they get the chills, it's pretty predictable where in the music they're going to get the chills. It happens at relatively predictable moments.
What, when a very recognizable melody comes
yeah,
in?
Yeah, it comes back. Usually not maybe the first time, but
comes
when it comes back.
Back,
like in Barber's Adagio.
Sure.
You know, you get that big, huge climax, and then you come back to that
yeah.
very simple melody.
That's
the time when you get the chills. when you have a solo solo line coming out of a cacophony of other music, like a guitar solo. Some people get it in, you know, Hotel California or Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You.
Oh, yeah.
So there are predictable patterns in terms of when we get the chills, and we can talk about those. But what I think is really interesting when it comes to the caudate is that when you look at brain activity in the caudate, while a person is anticipating the moment in which they're going to get their chills, their caudate is more active, the way it's tracking it.
So they're priming themselves for it.
Well, essentially, I think you're setting up the tension as an artist. And what you're doing is you're telling your audience, this is something that you need to pay attention to. Something important is about to happen. You're going to anticipate this, you know, release, whether it's, you know,
I'm thinking of Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet now. That's big, big build. And then finally you get to da 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 da.
Yeah, exactly. Or even, you know, the scene from Psycho in the shower, you know, where you're building up this.
That's Bernard Herrmann providing the music for that.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that when you have this caudate activation that is anticipating this release, when you actually get that shot of, you know, dopamine, the reward, the sublime feeling, that part of the brain's activity goes down, and up comes another part of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, which really is the part of the brain where if you put an electrode into a rat, into the nucleus accumbens, that rat will stimulate, you know, will press a bar to stimulate that region until it dies of starvation. It is more rewarding
so
than
it's a
anything
pleasure
else.
Response.
It's a pleasure response, yeah. So we have these two brain regions that are interacting and that are actually, we can track a good story on the basis of how they react to it.
Like a piece of music.
So the work has been done, you know, in music. So I just want to, you know, give kudos to Valerie Salimpour and Robert Satori at McGill who did some of this research. But, you know, this is where we can sort of watch great art having an effect on the brain within the framework of telling a good story, creating the tension, setting up that tension, and then releasing it.
Which in a story usually would be called the denouement, it could be called the climax. And that's another, neurological study that has been done fairly recently, that the climax of a piece of music, I've read this, has the same effect on the brain as, let's see, cocaine, chocolate, and sex.
So the reason that people say that is because some of the same brain regions are involved and the neurotransmitter dopamine is involved. Although I should say the neurotransmitter dopamine and these brain regions have a lot of different roles. So dopamine is involved in motor behavior. It's what's awry in people with Parkinson's disease. It's involved in working memory, so your ability to keep a phone number in mind. And it's involved in this salience network or this reward pathway. So it's a little bit simplistic, I think, to say that you have the exact same response when you listen to this piece of music and eat some chocolate. Because
same,
you don't have the same experience.
Same
right?
category, but lots of room in that category.
Exactly. But it's still very rewarding. And I think that's the underlying message here is that music, listening to music can be very rewarding, just like ingesting something that has like a direct physiological effect can be rewarding, whether it's cocaine or chocolate.
So tell me a story.
Oh boy. Okay. Well, I guess that's kind of it sort of depends on what the purpose of the story is. But I think the story that I'm sort of been thinking about more and more now more recently is this story of, you know, essentially where our humanity has come from and where it's going.
How long was this story?
it's not that long. But as I've already mentioned, so there is this wonderful social brain hypothesis about the fact that storytelling is something that maybe grew out of our need to understand each other, although, Robin Dummer doesn't say that explicitly, but that's sort of, you know, the interpretation that I have on it. But also when you're, you know, so when you're telling a great story, you want to engage with someone and you want to take them on this particular journey.
Right.
So let me take you on this journey of where we are now as human beings. So we've now got this brain. We've, you know, it's evolved a certain way. It's developed this capacity for storytelling. And enter the internet.
Right.
And all of a sudden, all of the things that we used to have to experience, we can now go into a world where all of that information is there. And in fact, we now have just discovered a way of creating a virtual reality. I just recently, you know, had the experience of trying out these virtual realities. And all of a sudden, the ability to tell stories and to exchange stories, I think, has grown exponentially. When you can immerse yourself into the story the way you can with virtual reality, the game changes. And I think it changes, in some ways, most excitingly for me, in terms of science, particularly neuroscience, of how we can understand our brains and how we can understand what's happening. Because now I can literally immerse myself into a simulation of a brain and see how it works. So it's not a very good story that I'm telling you. but
I'm waiting for the, you know, boy meets girl part of it here.
Oh, I guess I can tell you that kind of a story. Yeah, I can tell you the story of how my husband and I met.
So would this have to do with the man chart?
Oh, how do you know that? Yeah, so my husband and I were both graduate students, and we were competing for best talk at a conference. And I was told that, you know, because I'm a performer, it's going to be really easy for me to win this particular prize. So I went down there and watched, kind of smugly at the back of the room as, you know, a lot of these grad students were shuffling with their papers and stumbling over their words. And I was thinking, oh, this is going to be easy. And then my husband comes up to, or my future husband, I should say, comes up to the podium and tells this beautiful story about aplysia, which is a sea slug, and how he could map out the entire nervous system of this sea slug and show how this sea slug's nervous system changes with learning, plasticity. And it was just a beautiful story. And I remember just thinking, I just lost this prize. And sure enough, I did. And later on at the lunch, one of his friends went up to him and said, you know, I met this woman and, you know, she scares me, but I think you'll really like her. And someone, you know, said the same thing to me and we met. And now we actually have in Irvine, if you donate money to this memory building, you get a brick with your name on it. It's called Memory Lane.
Sure.
And if you win this prize, you also get a brick. So now we have these two bricks next to each other. And they're dated with the day in which we met, because I won the year after that, you know, when he was no longer in the running, I won the prize the year later. But we have these two bricks. And that's my memory of how we met, which, of course, doesn't necessarily need to be entirely accurate. It's possible that his remembering of how he met is very different.
And even though you and I have very different experiences and outlooks, I can, for the duration of that story, to some extent, I can be you. Now, there are things that appeal to me about us in that story, and that is, we have a laudable goal. We want to meet somebody. On the other hand, we're not perfect because we're a little overconfident, you know, a little too certain of ourselves, and we're setting ourselves up for, you know, a fall. Okay. And so what I like about that is, yes, you failed because there was somebody even better than you at this. But then the story has a plot twist in that in the long run, you won because you were able to, get together with, marry this person who had these commendable traits.
Yeah, and I think that actually gets at what is great storytelling, which is the ability of the storyteller to tell a story that is very human, and humans fail. There is a lot of failures. In fact, if you talk to roboticists who are trying to develop not artificial intelligence, but humanized intelligence,
yes, right?
One of the things that they do is they induce failures in their robots. And when they induce failures, the human beings actually seem to trust the robots more. So if the robot makes a mistake and apologizes for it, the human being says, oh, that's okay, and then, you know, instills in this trust in it. So sharing our failures and bonding in that way is something that we enjoy. You know, it builds that sense of trust, which gets back to this idea then that, you know, storytelling really is about understanding each other. Because if I understand where your failures are and I feel like I can relate to you and I'm not intimidated by you, I will create a social bond with you that will benefit both of us in the future.
And then we build on the experience we get from that failure.
Exactly.
Which is inevitable in any kind of organic existence.
Yeah, and if you look at politicians, you know, politicians who admit that they are human or that admit that they are that they have failed in some way often are trusted even more by their constituents or by, you know, by the people that they are that love them. It's not
worked for Bill Clinton.
Yeah, and you know, the current politicians on the in the docket now are they know this. It's nobody wants to see an entirely perfect individual because we know that nobody's perfect, so they're hiding something from us. But in fact, a lot of con artists use this tactic in order to con individuals out of their money because they start out with a vulnerable story. Oh, I need your help. I've lost my wallet. Can I just borrow your cell phone so that I can call, blah, blah, blah.
Just a little something from you to make it right.
Yes. I'm the one at fault. Can you help me? And that's how the con artist gains your trust. And it's really interesting that, people are able to understand that that this vulnerability has a power.
A few further observations about the need for storytelling when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Indre Viscontis, and we're looking at the neurological need or even the evolutionary need for storytelling. Now, we've covered a lot of ground, but we haven't really gotten into so much other than in the PTSD context, the way storytelling can actually change behavior.
Yeah, so that's something that a lot of scientists are interested in. How do we get people to either, change their beliefs about a particular myth that can be harmful to the society at large, or, how can we get people to change their behavior? So we know that stories are a compelling way to get people to remember information. But the question is, can we actually get them to change their behavior on the basis of a good story? And there's one study that I find really compelling. And it's it looks at mammogram rates in African-American women. And the study was set out to figure out whether when a woman watches a video of another African-American woman telling a story of her as a cancer survivor, how a mammogram might have saved her life, is that going to be more likely to lead her to seek her own mammogram? That compared with when she watches the same woman give a sort of authoritative, fact-based mm-hmm. presentation, right? And this is a really interesting question because in a lot of communities, there is a fear of the medical community. So the question is, actually, are we going to induce more behavioral change by, showing a relatable figure rather than an authority figure in a white coat, the medical doctor? And so they had these two videos, and it turns out that the women who watched the video in which the woman was telling the story rather than just, reciting a bunch of facts, those women showed that they were more likely to go and have a conversation at the dinner table about the film. They're more likely to remember the information from the film. They ended up having a higher fear of cancer than women who just watched the fact-based film. And ultimately, the women who were skeptical of the medical community were more likely to get a mammogram. So women who were more trusting of the medical community, it actually didn't matter whether they watched the video of the woman telling her story or the fact-based video. They were equally likely to go and get the mammogram. But in the population that was skeptical of the medical industry, their behavior changed. And to me, that's really interesting because it suggests that, storytelling has this power to, reach communities in ways that so many of the other methods that the medical community uses fail.
Well, Madison Avenue figured that out a long time ago. If you compare TV and radio commercials, say pre-1964 to those after, it was all about authority figures. It was all about pseudoscience, you know, meters that would tell you whether your breath was good or not. But then in 1964, Alka-Seltzer comes up with this campaign. It's called No Matter What Shape Your Stomach's In, and it shows people in various humorous situations where their stomach is taking a beating. And that was the beginning of what would be called really peer advertising. Instead of me, the physician, telling you, Andre, you need to go get a mammogram, it's somebody might even have a sort of a quirky, squeaky little voice telling you, you know, buy this product. It's, you know, it's a brioche and you want to get one because I enjoyed it and I'm sure you will too. And it really pretty much hasn't it driven advertising ever since. I mean, that's still the overall, if you go to the, you know, look at the ads on the Super Bowl, a lot of them are stories about, you know, your peers.
Yeah. In fact, they, you know, like antidepressant medications have like little cartoon characters that, you know, roll around and they're sad.
That's right.
You know,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, we have this. Yeah. And I, you know, I think that that really gets at the fact that we are engaged by stories. We're more interested. So we're more likely to pay attention. And really, attention is the, you know, the currency of the advertising world, right? They want to capture your attention.
Yes.
And if they can capture it with a great story and you'll pay attention to it, you know, the idea then is that they'll put their brand in front of you. In fact, there's now a whole industry of branded entertainment. So they're not even necessarily telling you to drink Coca-Cola. They're just giving you and showing you a good movie that you then associate with the brand.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of insight that's happening in the advertising world where they're understanding that, you know, people's attention, you know, it's a sought-after commodity, and stories are a great way to engage people. We want to know what's happening next. And you know, we love to predict what's happening next. We also love to be surprised, as long as it makes sense within the framework or the rules of the world that the story is created, right? So sometimes if you have like a bizarre piece of music or a bizarre movie and, you know, you can't make sense of the events, we don't find that as enjoyable. We can't track it.
Our says a lot about music, doesn't it, though? I mean, you know, this long experiment with music that most people who weren't musicologists couldn't track it.
Yeah, that's right. There's a very strong connection between your experience with a particular genre of music and your ability to understand the rules that follow in that genre and your likability of that music, your pleasure rating for whether you like it. So, for example, if you've never listened to jazz before and you listen to some complicated improvisation, it's not going to be as enjoyable to you as if you are the person who's been listening to jazz for 30 years and you can follow along the riff and you can see how they are bending the rules but still staying within that framework. That's all about storytelling, right? It's like you understand the scaffold of what's happening, and you're curious to see how the characters are going to navigate through it.
Okay, Andre is an opera singer. Let's say I've never heard an opera.
Yeah.
Am I going to start with Mozart or Carlisle Floyd?
Ah, it's a good question. I've actually sung both. I just covered Susanna in January, and I've sung a number of Mozart roles. But you know, I think that to me, you know, it has to come from a good story. So that's what the first opera goer, you know, if you're a first time opera goer, you've got to go to an opera that has a great story. And I actually usually recommend Puccini. Why? Because it has wonderful melodies, some of which you'll recognize. The story ticks right along. There aren't any, you know, breaks, and it's a rich story. And it's often filled with characters, especially Bohème, which is the opera that I most likely recommend, that are very relatable. I mean, it's the...
Yeah, it tends to be realistic.
Yeah, they're starving artists living in Paris, and you know it was written 100 or premiered 120 years ago, and we just did a production in San Francisco where starving artists portrayed starving artists. I mean, it was art imitating life you know, to the nth degree. But yeah, that's what I would say. And to me, I think actually it's the part of the. It's the responsibility of the musician to provide the framework. So tell the audience what to listen for if the audience doesn't know for sure. Because without that framing, it's very hard to know how to track the story.
Andre Viscontis, thank you for giving us the story behind storytelling.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Can't wait to find out what else you discover in that future, which we can imagine. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.